Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. Welcome to episode 143 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lincook, and as always, I'll be your host today. Now, today's episode is kind of the last in the kind of three-part series is a loose word. We'll use the word series quite loosely, but in the kind of series that has been occurring over the past two episodes, this being the third. But this was actually the first kind of episode I conceptualized in my mind when I thought about the things I wanted to talk about, and this kind of answering the question, has anything changed really from, you know, the time my grandparents were about my age in Britain in the 60s. And so I kind of, you know, thought about all of this because of what was happening with the far right during the summer. I mean, I did an episode on it, but it was quite reactionary. It came out during the time that the riots and despicable behaviour, to be honest, was occurring. And so this is kind of an episode with a little bit more distance between that time and now, but also kind of still living within this moment where people are being sentenced for different crimes associated with their racism and their racist beliefs. And I was kind of pondering the question, why don't people get charged with racism? Like, why don't racists go to prison for being racist? And like, I know the answer to that, the simple answer is because it's like quite difficult to prove someone's racist, and that the activity they did that was criminal was because of their racist views. But I think seeing some of the convictions and seeing what people are going to prison for, those that have been tried and convicted based on what happened, it's really interesting how few of them are going to prison with anything to do with racism on their record. And of course we all know that it would be linked to that potentially, and Islamophobia and all kinds of intolerance and just like general prejudice and discrimination. And we all know that, and we know if they were at certain riots and, you know, uprisings, I don't even know what you call them anymore, the Farage riots, I think that's my favorite term I've heard. If they were there, then we can probably assume, and correctly assume, but that actually won't be on their record. There's very few cases. And then it kind of brings me to Maria Hussein, who was charged with racially aggravated public order offence, which, if you say to me, you know, someone was charged with racially aggravated public order offence in 2024, I would be looking at the people that were burning hotels that had asylum seekers in, burning libraries, you know, disrupting cities and areas across the UK this summer. Not Maria Hussein, who was at a Free Palestine rally, an organised march that had permission, with a placard that had a very legitimate political criticism of Suella Braverman and Rishi Sunak, referring to them as coconuts. It is not a racial slur. It's never been used. I've never heard it as a racial slur. I'm not saying it's never ever been used as one. I've never heard it being used as a racial slur. It's a political critique. And the fact that, you know, like, professors had to give up their day, like, legal experts had to give up their time to go to court to say that these words, this term coconut, was used, you know, as political critique. Professor Gus John, who they didn't even want, the prosecution said, how can we believe this man's credible? Professor Gus John, the disrespect of it. Professor Kehinde Andrews was there as well, you know. They took that to prove this, which is crazy to me, when you've got people that actually have said and done much worse to actually put the lives of black, of Muslim people, of Asian people, of immigrants, asylum seekers, refugees, like literally their lives at risk. Yeah, it's Marie Hussein who the prosecution they were going for. Thank goodness she was found not guilty. I don't know what this episode would have been like if she, you know, if that had gone any other way. It literally couldn't have gone any other way. There's just no possible way. But also the fact that she was pregnant, she is pregnant, 9 months, I believe. And this is what they have dragged her through. At a time where, you know, budgets are tight across the country, across every institution, budgets are tight. Across every household, budgets are tight. And they've dragged this woman through court. Yet you've got people like Francis Xavier James Hester, known as Frank Hester to us all, but I thought I'd call out his government name just because it's quite a long one, isn't it? You know, saying things like Diane Abbott makes him want to hate all black women and that she should be shot. And they are quotes, direct quotes. And I've said this before on this episode. You guys know if you've listened. He's saying things like that. It's like, where's his day in court? What's going on? Yeah, you've got Maria Hussein at a protest with a coconut placard in the docks, like in a court, in a trial. It's insane to me. This country is insane. The way it handles racism is absolutely insane. Anyway, all this insanity led me to this episode. We're going on a journey, I'll say. We're going to think a little bit more about the far right and this history of anti-immigrant sentiment, and we're going to go all the way back. We're going to go, well, not as far back as I've ever been before on this podcast, but we're going to, you know, turn back the hands of time to even Queen Victoria and her sentiments. I'm going to think about, yep, history of the far right and their rioting and disturbances, and then we're going to look at the fallout of these race riots in 2024. But before I do all that, I'm going to tell you about a live show, another one. We have another one. We had one yesterday, actually, because I am recording this the day before publication. So yesterday I took to the stage at the London Podcast Festival and had a sensational time. It was lovely to meet you listeners and people that came to support the show and to listen in. It was great to be joined on the stage by Dr. Jade Bentall. We had such a good conversation, honestly. It just was the most beautiful day and a very special day, it being the first. I have another one lined up on the 19th of October, 2024. And that is part of the Imperial War Museum's like live podcast festival thing. And I will be in conversation with Colin Douglas, who is an author and historian, and we will be talking about his book, The Caribbean and the Second World War. We'll also be thinking about military histories, why they're important, you know, why they've excluded Caribbean people for so long, and what this book will do as an intervention in those histories. I know it will be another good day. There's also going to be a podcasting panel at the end of the day. I think the show with myself and Colin will be at 4 p.m. And then the show, the kind of panel with myself and other podcasters will be later on in the evening in the Churchill War Rooms at the Imperial War Museum. So if you are around in London, in the area, want to stop in. There are also a lot of other podcasts on the day that will be specifically talking about military histories, not all to do with the Caribbean. But it will be interesting if that is your thing. Yes, so do check out their website for more information. Everything will be linked in the show notes below if you do want more information or want to book tickets. This summer, we saw the far right taking to the streets, following the murder of three young girls at a Taylor Swift-themed dance class in Southport. Violence followed the cruel attacks when rumours were falsely spread that the suspect was a Muslim immigrant. Far-right rioters, believed to be associated with the EDL, clashed with police outside of a mosque as they made Islamophobic chants. Rioters attacked a mosque and in the days that followed mobilised in other areas, setting fire to a hotel that housed asylum seekers at the call of Lucy Connolly, 41 years old, who was a childminder and the wife of a Tory councillor who serves West Northamptonshire Council. She called for mass deportations and for the hotels housing asylum seekers to be set on fire on social media. As of the 6th of September, police have made 1,380 arrests and 863 charges have been brought in total since the unrest began in June. The oldest person to be charged is an 81-year-old and the youngest is 11, which in some ways is a real shame in the story, and the real shame of the story, because racism, and especially this kind of extreme racism and prejudice, was always said to be of the older generation, a symptom of time and something that would die out. And that's what I heard a lot growing up. You know, racist people were old, stuck in their ways, and they just didn't know better. But here we are with an 11-year-old who was not only at one set of riots, but two. It's sad because it's clearly ever-prevalent and ever-growing racism, Islamophobia, prejudice, discrimination. And it's just so much more violent and determined that politicians or the media will give it credit for. Probably because, in part, they know they're responsible. And if they don't know, then, well, I don't know how they wouldn't know. Because the rhetoric that comes from the far-right press, as I call it, but I don't even think they would view themselves as far right, and certain politicians of late, and across the kind of last 10, maybe even 15 years, is just so clearly anti-immigrant, it's Islamophobic, it's racist, it's horrible. Last month, the United Nations entered this conversation, last month being August, if you are listening after the time of this being published, and the UN Department Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, CERD or CERD, said in a statement, and I quote, "It was particularly concerned about recurring racist acts and violence against ethnic and ethno-religious minorities, migrants, refugees and asylum seekers by extremist far-right and white supremacist individuals and groups," end quote. Including the violence that took place in July and August in that assessment. History in its majority has shown Britain to be intolerant at best, but truly downright racist, fascist and xenophobic at worst to a vast majority of people that become marginalised once they move here. From Jewish people from Eastern Europe in the 19th century to the Irish who came later on, the global population of sailors, pilots, soldiers that fought in their wars to the Caribbean post-war migrants and West African students, as well as the many, many groups of people fleeing things like civil war, genocide, persecution, conflict elsewhere in the world. Most of them arriving because of Britain's colonial past and the way that they have continuously involved themselves in global disputes, thinking specifically about the Middle East there, due to their former position as major European colonisers, and due to the way that they are positioned in alliance with certain countries and their commitment to organisations like NATO. Britain has had a hand in so much global conflict, it's actually a joke. Like, it can't be serious. The fact that they colonise such a large proportion of the planet, and now here we are at a time where these same people that were impacted by the pillage and rape of their natural resources, the destruction of culture, tradition and values and people, the removal of people from their homelands. They've been impacted by war, genocide, famine, climate-based issues, displacement, a lack of natural resource, and so opportunities to kind of lead a life that they want to, that's prosperous, that has some kind of elevation in it, you know, in the lands of their birth, is impossible due to these imperial legacies, essentially ruining their country from the way things were, you know, when times were better. So it's really interesting that the people are not making historical links. Like, we're not linking certain movements of people to Britain's colonial legacy. We're not linking the fact that genocide and war caused by the fallout of colonization is leading to people wanting to move here for safety or for a better life. It's so interesting to me that that link is not being made clearly, eloquently by anyone, really, in a position of power or a position of platform and voice. It just seems to be, I guess historians are making it, people that have sense are making it, but unfortunately the people that have sense don't typically have the largest platforms or the biggest microphones. It's not in our education system for people to make these links either. It's not in our education system to teach about imperialism, empire, its legacies, just kings and queens. And I've said this so many times, but it's something echoed in a blog post I read by Dr. Lambros Fatsis. And I'm going to use a lot of his blog. He's a senior lecturer in criminology at City University London. And he writes a lot. Well, he wrote an article about the far right and actually made these historical links so beautifully that, you know, this episode would be very little without that blog post, because it is really, really good. And I'll link it below if you would like to read it. Now, I'll take a quote from Dr. Lambros in his blog. And he says, and I told you we're going back to Queen Victoria today. Queen Victoria complained about, and I quote, "too many of these kind of people" in the Old English spelling. Samuel Estwick called upon Lord Mansfield to introduce legislation to prohibit the entry of black people in Britain to, and I quote, "preserve the race of Britons from stain and contamination." Oh, imagine thinking about people as like contamination, like thinking about actual human beings as being contaminants. Insane. The White Defence League decried the, and I quote, "evils of coloured invasion, mass interbreeding and the emergence of mulatto Britain that apparently signals the downfall of the civilizations and culture of our economy." Dr. Fastis goes on to mention Enoch Powell, who railed against wide-grinning pickaninnies and an immigrant-descended population and their dependents. And Margaret Thatcher went on to say, "people who are, quote, really rather afraid that this country might be rather swamped by people with a different culture," end quote. It's so interesting to me, the way this rhetoric doesn't change much. This idea of, you know, too many of this kind of people and this coloured invasion and it being a stain, and this idea of people being, you know, swamping this country, referring to human beings with words you would only use for animals, you know, like swarms, we've seen in the press in more recent times, similar to the situation in Palestine, and the way that Palestinians are referred to in the media as well. Dehumanization consistently happening as far back as we can go when it comes to immigration and people that, you know, the political media elites have decided are just not desirable, desirable enough to be given human characteristics and qualities. But you can see there's a long history of this, and this anti-immigrant feeling, and why I'm speaking about it is because it's a clear element of the far right and their views. Now, in more modern times, we're fast-forwarding to 1948, when the Windrush arrived, but it nearly didn't. It really nearly didn't. Oh, it really didn't. And in an article from The Guardian in 2018 by David Olusoga, he said, and I quote, "even before the Windrush had left Britain, the Prime Minister Clement Attlee had examined the possibility of preventing its embarkation or diverting the ship and the migrants on board to East Africa." Funny that. The East Africa plan, the Rwanda plan, been in place, it's been in conversation since 1948. After the vessel had arrived at Tilbury, the colonial secretary, Arthur Creech Jones, is said to have reassured his cabinet colleagues that although, and I quote, "these people have British passports and must be allowed to land, there's nothing to worry about because they won't last one winter in England," end quote. And that quote comes from Randall Hanson's book, Citizenship and Immigration in Postwar Britain, cited in the David Olusoga article from The Guardian. "They won't last one winter in England" is insane to me. It's insane to me, three generations later, sitting at my IKEA desk, talking about Britain's racism, knowing my grandparents did very much last more than one winter. I think they lasted 60 winters, maybe even 70. Crazy, insane. And here we are with, You know what? It's actually laughable when you think about it. I love that. I think that's one of the reasons I love history so much, because you can just see how things have turned out, but actually how people thought about them at the time and how people thought things would turn out. The disparity is often hilarious. What's actually scary is when people get it really right and you're like, ooh, like you really knew. How did you know? But yeah, here we are in 2024 with very similar sentiments that were clear in 1948, clear when Queen Victoria was on the throne, and everybody in between that, really. Again, let's fast forward to 2015. Prime Minister David Cameron, when asked about the Calais crisis, he spoke about, and I quote, a swarm of people coming across the Mediterranean seeking a better life, wanting to come to Britain. Labour's Harriet Hartman, former mother of the house, said, and I quote, he should remember he's talking about people and not insects, and referenced the language he used as divisive and taking a worrying turn. Now, he was taking a worrying turn, and it was a start of a rise in that kind of language, but that kind of language wasn't new, if you know what I mean. We've heard it before. But yeah, referring to people as a swarm, that was kind of the beginning, I think, in my understanding anyway, as a teenager probably at the time, hearing people be dehumanised. People that he acknowledges are just seeking a better life. And Britain, them kind of in their perception, is the place for that. I wonder why. Maybe because it is, all right? Maybe because Britain has stolen the wealth of the world and has made itself a giant economy that is prosperous and wealthy, and people want a piece of it. Like, it's not rocket science. I think in Britain, we often think that we're like a developing country. This is not a developing country. The economy is huge. Yes, things might be tight. I understand every single institution is, you know, struggling financially. Why are we here? Because it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. I'm not an economist, but that all these institutions are struggling financially, but this economy is so big and one of the greatest in the world. Maybe the wrong people are getting rich. Maybe the wrong people are taking all the money and leaving the people and institutions that need it to suffer. I wonder. And then in 2016, it was like the Brexit referendum time. And, you know, as this country prepared to decide whether it wanted to stay in the EU or not, actually, it was UKIP that continued to keep its focus on immigration. And they actually aired a political broadcast which focused solely on the prospect of Turkey joining the European Union. And in that video, which at the time, granted, did receive widespread criticism for its racist and Islamophobic undertones, UKIP claimed that essentially if Turkey would join, they would join by 2020, and that as many as 15 million people would leave the country for the EU in its first 10 years of membership. And it was so funny reading this, because obviously in 2024, Turkey still actually haven't joined the EU. They haven't been able to. And so UKIP put all this time and energy and literal money into this campaign to scare people, to, you know, fearmonger, something that wasn't realistically even going to happen. And if it did, actually, the implications of it would not have been that 15 million people would leave Turkey. Like, you know, some people actually like the places that they are in and are living in. This idea that Britain is a prize for everybody is just not the case. Might be for some, but not for everyone. I could cite so many things during Brexit with this kind of anti-immigrant sentiment, but this episode is not about Brexit. And it's actually quite a painful thing, actually, for someone of my age that Brexit even happened. I still really, really, like, deep that. Like, I'm really like, how did that happen? Like, how did that happen? And honestly, I really do think that it has negatively impacted young people's lives in this country quite significantly, especially like in a kind of student Erasmus opportunities abroad in Europe, free movement for young people kind of way. BNP, UKIP, now Reform, their rise in the last 10 to 15 years has been not concerning, because they feel like they've always been there. The far right within political parties, it's not uncommon. But I think at this point with the 2024 elections, where Reform gained, and I say gained because they had no seats before because they were Reform and Reform anew, 14.3% of the vote, of the whole vote, they got 5 seats. They won 2 seats in the East Midlands, Ashfield and Boston and Skegness. 3 seats in the East of England, Clacton, Nigel Farage won a seat, finally. It's about time, actually, sir. Because for all your yapping, you've never been an elected member of parliament. But unfortunately, now he is. They also won Great Yarmouth and South Basildon and East Thurrock. And all the Reform gains, interestingly, were from Conservative seats. So they are seats that the Conservatives would have won in 2019 on the current boundaries. Yeah, really interesting, the fact that they didn't take votes from, you know, a Labour, which is said to be a little bit more on the left or centre. They took votes from the Conservatives because they believe that the Conservatives weren't going to be tough enough on immigration, which is interesting to me considering the Rwanda plan was a plan that they were very much going ahead with. But it says a lot about the political landscape right now, with 5 seats, you know, within UK Parliament going to Reform and their views and their beliefs. Now that takes us up to the present moment with these riots in the UK. But before we kind of get there, I've given you the anti-immigrant sentiment timeline, a very abridged version. I'm now going to give you another timeline of far-right racism, an uprising, riot, conflict, however you want to define it. Starting in 1860 with the Tyneside Riots, which was a conflict between seamen, not uncommon at the time. 1919, we saw race riots in Liverpool after a black man was alleged to have made an offensive remark to a white woman. Also, around the same time in Cardiff and Glasgow, tensions between white union workers and black and Arab and Chinese servicemen led to riots in port cities, Glasgow, Cardiff, which I've done episodes on before, and then the lynching of Charles Wootton in Liverpool in 1919, which, you know, led, was in the midst of a riot and led to further unrest. And it's noted the fact that following that, it was the black workers that were kind of bore the brunt of the blame for these uprisings, despite the fact it was not them that started it. There was the Battle of Cable Street in 1936 in October, where Oswald Mosley led his black shirt supporters on a march through the East End of London, following months of meetings and leafleting in the area designed to intimidate Jewish people and break up the East End community solidarity. Despite a petition signed by 100,000 people, the government allowed the march to continue and designated members of the police force to go with it, 7,000 members of the police force. There was a counter-protest from Cable Street community members, as well as members of the Jewish and Irish communities, local workers and local Labour and Communist parties, and they succeeded in disbanding the march of Oswald Mosley's black shirts and the BUF. The BUF standing for the British Union of Fascists. In 1958, there were the Notting Hill race riots, which followed very closely racial unrest in Nottingham in the Midlands. In that part of London at that time, a lot of white working class teens were kind of part of the Teddy Boy movement, would associate themselves as Teddy Boys, inflamed by groups like Oswald Mosley's union movement and other far-right groups like the White Defence League, which urged people, white people, to keep Britain white. KBW was seen graffitied on a lot of walls. Keep Britain White was seen also on shop fronts and on places that they assumed immigration would mean that there would be an increase in communities that weren't white British. And this led to tensions. It led to violent attacks on black people throughout the summer of 1958. And this eventually led to clashes. And I think the situation in Notting Hill, in these examples that I've given, which are very much the far right rioting and causing disturbances, this became a clash because of the way that white people had been terrorizing black people in the area of Notting Hill in 1958 and the months and years that had come before. And if we can get to 1977 and the Battle of Lewisham, which, as you know, there's been an episode on already. I've spoken a lot about it already in episode 140, as well as the previous episode. Obviously, you know, these are me picking out the kind of largest moments of far-right uprisings in this country. But it kind of brings us nicely to 2024. And I think the parallels between the Battle of Lewisham and the moment in 2024, especially kind of viewing Lewisham as an area that was alleged to have been targeted by the far right, and in fact the counter-protest was bigger than any far-right presence that could have been mustered up by them. Now, my initial question of why don't people get charged with racism, why don't racists go to prison for racism, it still stands. I still don't have an answer. I'm not sure I'm going to get one. And I'll bring you back to the kind of starting point with this kind of moment that we're in now, where we're seeing people get charged and Keir Starmer's, you know, bringing down the rule of law and justice on these people, which I don't necessarily... controversial. I don't know how I feel about this. There's an 11-year-old, as I mentioned at the start, being tried for his presence and contribution to the riots. Now, his case kind of also comes into the public understanding because his mom was in Ibiza when it was time for sentencing. She sent him to court with his uncle, and she said that she didn't realise that she personally needed to be there, but, you know, thought she could send another responsible adult, which in that case was the uncle. She was fined, actually, £1,200, which a judge noted was very similar to the cost of her £1,000 holiday to Ibiza, and also was not sentenced, but has to do a parenting course. And it got me thinking, actually, what do you do with an 11-year-old boy who, in trial, realistically, didn't actually know what he was doing there? He thought it was funny. He thought it was, you know, hilarious to stop a bus that was then set upon by rioters and attacked, leaving the bus driver and the passengers terrified. He thought it was funny to be caught up in that. He said he didn't even know what an asylum seeker was. So not him actually harbouring any racist views, but just being caught up in the violence. And not to say that I kind of can sympathise with that or understand that, but I wondered how many of those people that have been caught up in this would do better with, like, some kind of education. And this is not to portray all of them as being uneducated, because some of them are highly educated and know exactly why their views are wrong and what their views are and where they come from. But not all of them are. And I wonder how many of them could sit in, you know, them like corporate anti-racist training things that people talk about. Like, would that benefit people? Because it does seem for a lot of people like a lack of education, and putting people in prison for things like this, as much as I understand it, and it makes sense because they're a danger to society if they are burning hotels with asylum seekers in them. Is that going to radicalise them further? Is that going to push them further into their behaviours? A lot of people that are part of the far right are radicalised online, through social media, through the kind of incel chains, the dark web. I'm saying a lot of words that I've heard thrown around, but also have heard from people that are caught up in the far right or have been in the past and actually been able to see the light. They've said that the algorithm catches them on social media platforms like YouTube, Facebook, TikTok and the like, where they start, you know, thinking about the problems that they face in their own lives and in society, and next thing they know, they're down a rabbit hole where Muslims and immigrants and black people are the reason for all their problems and Britain's problems. Now, Keir Starmer, as he led the sentencing and, you know, was in charge of bringing in these 24-hour courts in 2011 when there were uprisings and riots. And, you know, he allowed magistrates to hand down harsher punishments We might remember those tougher sentences of 13 years ago when a 4-year sentence for 2 men who used Facebook to incite disorder. A man was handed 6 months in prison for stealing £3.50 worth of water. You know, stories like that. And now, you know, he's implementing similar sentencing and harsher punishments on people now. But I'm still not seeing many people be tried with racism. And I get it in this context because I'm not sure how many people they actually caught in the act of saying things that were racist or, you know, doing things because of racial prejudice. It's really difficult to prove. But, you know, a lot of people are being tried and charged with things like violent disorder. Now, Arise Greenwood, 31, who live-streamed racial slurs during the riots in Sunderland, got a 2.5-year sentence for violent disorder. Now, he live-streamed racial slurs. So there is no question of, you know, was he being racist or not? He live-streamed the slurs. So how come he didn't get what Maria Hussein was charged with? Julie Sweeney, 53, she was sentenced to 15 months in prison in August for posting inflammatory messages on Facebook. Inflammatory is a crazy word. I'm quoting that. The post read, and I quote, "Blow the mosque up with the adults in it." That is Islamophobic. I don't see how that's not Islamophobic. I don't get how lawyers can't prove that. Like, maybe I'm being obtuse. And she was charged with communication threatening death or serious harm, which, of course, is serious. It's whoever you're, you know, threatening death to, it's serious, whether they're black, white, Muslim, Christian or otherwise. And I could probably assume that that would carry a longer charge than something to do with Islamophobia. But I guess my question is why? Why? why is this the case? And why does it seem like it is black and Asian people that are dealing with charges to do with racism more so than the far right, who by nature, one of the often, you know, one of the like criteria for being in the far right typically is anti-immigrant sentiments, racism, sexism, things of that nature. So yeah, lots of thoughts, things to think about. And in regards to the question, or has anything changed, I'm not so sure if it has. Of course, you know, in the grand scheme of things, life is so much better, probably for me, than it was for my grandparents in the 60s. But when we break things down, you know, section by section, societal institution by societal institution, whilst there are obviously things that are so much better, education being one of them, the access to information we have thanks to the internet and books and the way we can kind of see what's going on. Sometimes obviously it's definitely too much, but you know, we're so much more aware of what's happening, not just here but all over the world, because of technology. And you know, there's brilliant things that have come from that. But when, you know, we take these institutions like policing, the media, politics and you know, the far right, it's interesting kind of how little has changed or how cyclical things are, and the cycles just continue and continue. And you kind of wonder, like, will the like cycle stop? Will it burst? Will things change for real? But we won't know. We've got to live it out. We've got to keep watching. That is all I have for you today. I want to remind you again of the live shows at the Imperial War Museum, and thank everybody for their support with History Hotline events in the past, like the quiz and the live show just yesterday. So thank you all for listening to this episode and this series more broadly. I hope you have a wonderful week. Goodbye.